Welcome back to VersantCast. Thank you for your patience during our unplanned hiatus. We hope that you and yours are staying safe and healthy during the COVID-19 pandemic. In today's episode, we sit down with Dr. David Townsend, co-inventor of the PET CT scanner. The PET CT scanner, developed by Dr. Townsend and Dr. Ronald Nutt, was named by Time Magazine as the Medical Invention of the Year in 2000. Dr. Townsend obtained his BS in physics and his PhD in particle physics. He was also a staff member for 8 years at the European Center for Nuclear Research, or CERN, in Geneva, Switzerland. He has received honorary doctorates from the University of the Mediterranean in Marseille, France, and the University of Bristol in the UK. He was elected an honorary fellow of the Royal College of Radiologists in London. Dr. Townsend has co-authored over 175 peer-reviewed publications and book chapters, is a reviewer for a number of scientific journals, and has served as an associate editor for the Journal of Nuclear Medicine. More recently, he received the prestigious Paul C. Ebersold Award from the Society of Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Imaging, as well as the Edward J. Hoffman Medical Imaging Scientist Award from the IEEE-NSSMIC, and shared the Roplat Medal for co-authoring the 2016 Most Cited Paper in Physics, in Medicine, and Biology.
Hello, Dr. Townsend. Welcome, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Dr. Ramsey. It's actually a great pleasure to be here. I very much thank you for inviting me to participate in this podcast.
Absolutely. Before we begin our discussion on the topic of PET-CT, how are things with respect to coronavirus where you are in Canada?
Well, I think I'm very fortunate to be here. I'm in Whistler in British Columbia, and some early decisions by the BC government meant that the situation here has not been bad at all. In fact, today there were only 9 new cases in well-identified areas of BC. And the total number of deaths in BC is 164. So in actual fact, we feel very fortunate to be here. Whistler has a population of 12,000, and we have a lot of mountains, lakes, parks, valley trails that we can use without any problems about social distancing. All that seems to be very well handled. So we feel very fortunate to have sat out the lockdown here in Whistler.
Right. That does sound ideal, especially with being outdoors where distance can be maintained and in an environment as pleasant as you have described.
That's right. Yeah, it's a ski resort. And since the U.S.-Canadian border is closed to non-essential traffic until June 21st, the sort of influx of tourists has not been possible, which of course is not great for local businesses, but it keeps us isolated. So essentially all the people you encounter are local residents. As far as we know, there isn't really any cases of infection in the town.
That's wonderful. You've had a long and distinguished career in physics. Were you always disposed towards physics, even as a small boy? Or did you come to it later, more as a decision for a career?
Well, the educational system in the United Kingdom, which is where I grew up, means that you made, back in those days, a serious choice of sort of life direction about 16 when I moved into the sixth form. And there I had to decide between arts and sciences, which meant studying languages and classics versus studying science. And with some influence from my father and my local physics master, I was persuaded to go into the scientific direction. So physics at the University of Bristol, since I grew up in Cornwall in the southwest of England back in the 60s, traveling was not as easy as it is today. So getting out of Cornwall to the rest of England took a lot longer than it does now. And Bristol was the closest well-rated university. And it was also the university where my physics master had done his degree. So I registered as a physics student in Bristol. at the University of Bristol, and that kind of launched me onto my scientific career in physics.
Yes, I'm familiar with the British system for high school as I went through it myself, and also when I hit sixth form, where you prepare for your A-levels, I also went into science. From my own personal experience, I can say that I found that method of education to be quite rigorous. So, physics today is a broad field. What subset did you specialize in?
Well, I obviously covered all the topics while I was doing my undergraduate work in Bristol. And it happened in Bristol that every year a senior physicist from the European Centre for Nuclear Research, CERN, came and gave some lectures in Bristol. It was rather unusual for CERN staff members to give lectures at outside universities, but this had been set up many years previously. And so Dr. Francis Farley came to the University of Bristol and gave some lectures on particle physics and the work he was doing at CERN. And he encouraged people from our class to apply for a CERN summer student opportunity. CERN took, I think, about 100 summer students from all over Europe. And the University of Bristol had an allocation of about two such students. And so I was inspired by Francis Farley's lectures that I applied to be a summer student and was fortunate, myself and a friend were fortunate to be accepted. So in the summer of 1966, I was taken on as a summer student at CERN and worked on Francis Farley's groundbreaking experiment at the time. And so I got involved between undergraduate and a decision on PhD in elementary particle physics and had the opportunity to work at CERN, which is, of course, the premier laboratory in the world now. And so I spent 2 or 3 months at CERN during the summer of 1966 and decided that was the sort of field I wanted to be involved in. And so I got accepted to do a PhD at the University of London. I actually went to a college which has now been absorbed into another college called, so I was at Westfield College and worked closely with the group at Imperial College and had the opportunity to have lectures from Nobel Prize winners who were faculty at Imperial College. So I did my PhD and my PhD work at the University of London in particle physics and acquiring data for the experiment that I was working on at the Rutherford Laboratory near Didcot, near Oxford, working on a device called a bubble chamber, which was the fashionable device in those days for examining and recording interactions between high energy particles. And that data I then wrote up as my PhD, which I submitted to the University of London in 1970. So it was a choice that was basically inspired by Francis Farley. And I, just out of interest, I actually Googled him before you called and found that he is now 99 years old and is living in the south of France and is still alive. It's quite an amazing career. And he was a very fascinating guy, although when I first met him in 1966, I didn't realize what a celebrity he was going to be.
Sure. The work you did with him at CERN, was that on the famous magnetic moment of the muon?
Indeed it was. It was to measure it was called the G-2 experiment to measure the magnetic moment of the muon to very high levels of accuracy. I think 10 or 11 decimal places at the time. But it was a highly inspiring group of individuals. One gentleman in particular, who was the engineer on the experiment, was somebody called Simon van der Meer. And Simon van der Meer shared the Nobel Prize with Carlo Rubbia some years later for his work on proton-antiproton interactions. So it was a very inspiring group, and I guess that's what inspired me to go in that direction and start a PhD in particle physics.
You have a very good pedigree, Dr. Townsend, and I suppose you could have continued doing that line of work in particle physics, but you moved away from particle physics into the area of medical physics. What happened that caused you to make this switch?
Well, I was very fortunate, and having been inspired by Francis and my work at CERN as a summer student, I was inspired to pursue job opportunities at CERN. And so 1 year after I finished my PhD course, I remained at the college doing some computer work, but looking for a permanent job somewhere, and an opportunity arose at CERN. And so in late 1969, I moved to Geneva and started working at CERN prior to submitting my PhD. So I was very fortunate to actually have a job in the field before I had even technically completed my PhD. So I was assigned to a number of experiments at CERN over the subsequent 8 or 9 years. But a major event, for me at least, happened in about 1975 when a friend and physicist, Dr. Alan Jevons, approached me. Alan was also working at CERN, but he was a solid-state physicist. He'd done his work at Durham University in solid-state physics. And he had got involved while working at CERN with a small solid-state group at the University of Geneva, directed by Professor Martin Peter. And he had then got involved in making some small detectors that were capable of measuring the position of photons, 511 keV photons that originated from positron annihilation, used for not for medical imaging, but for imaging Fermi surfaces in complex metals. And that was the objective of this group at the University of Geneva. So totally different from what he was doing at CERN and what I was doing at CERN. But in pursuing the use of positron-emitting isotopes, he had come across the potential for medical applications. So this was very early in the field, in 1974-1975. And one day in the cafeteria, he handed me a paper which had been written by the group at UCLA and UC Berkeley on using similar detectors to the ones that Alan was using in solid-state physics for imaging positron-emitting isotopes for medical applications. And it outlined a reconstruction algorithm. So I got interested in that because of the I was interested in the mathematics of the reconstruction, but also in the application of positron-emitting isotopes for medical imaging rather than solid-state work, which wasn't really my interest or my field. We very early started then to look at the possibilities of applying positron-emitting isotopes in medicine. And were inspired by the work of Mike Phelps and his group and others in the field. And I started to look at programming the reconstruction algorithms, which was my primary interest. And then we started making contacts with various people in the fields just to see where this was possibly going. And one of the people that we contacted was the head of nuclear medicine at the University of Geneva, Professor Alfred Donat, who was a very visionary and very enthusiastic nuclear medicine physician in Switzerland. Professor Donat then kind of inspired us to continue this work. So in 1975, I went to London and met Professor Terry Jones, who was a true inspiration and one of my great mentors in my entire career. He was working at the Medical Research Council at Hammersmith Hospital, and he had recently returned from a sabbatical in the United States and was inspired to start a positron emission tomography imaging group at the Medical Research Council with support from the MRC and based in the psychotron unit at Hammersmith Hospital. And he, Terry, inspired us to continue to look at the detectors that Alan Jevons had built at CERN for medical applications. And then in communication with Professor Donat at the University of Geneva, we kind of formed a small group in PET imaging back in 1977, 1978. And at that point, I became sufficiently interested in the applications of physics, the applications of detectors to the medical imaging problems that I decided in 1978, 1979 that I would prefer a career in medical imaging to the one that I had originally pursued in particle physics. So in 1979, I decided to leave CERN and was very fortunate that my collaboration with Alfred Donat at the university resulted in him opening a position for me as a physicist in his nuclear medicine department at the University of Geneva Hospital. So in 1979, prior to moving to the university hospital, I was fortunate enough to spend a few months at the State University of New York in Buffalo. The imaging group there was run by Professor Gabor Herman, who was a true pioneer in tomography and, in fact, published a paper on tomographic imaging and reconstruction algorithms a year or two before Godfrey Hansfield announced his invention of the CT scanner. That occurred in 1972, and Gabor had been writing papers on reconstruction and tomography 2 or 3 years earlier. So it was an opportunity to get involved in a world-class medical imaging group, even though the application was to computed tomography with X-rays, not in nuclear medicine imaging or PET. But I had the opportunity then to work with people that have gone on to have stellar careers in imaging in other fields, CT and even nuclear medicine after he moved to the University of Pennsylvania. But it was a tremendous opportunity. And so I came back to Geneva in 1979, having spent some inspiring months in Buffalo, and began a career in medical imaging at the University Hospital of Geneva under the direction of Professor Alfred Donat.
Very interesting. You know, it's very common in the case of people who have had great careers that when you ask them their history, it seems as if serendipity also plays a big part in terms of people they meet along the way and who are decisive in terms of helping them to go in the direction they eventually did. Well, you're mostly linked in the minds of people as being the co-inventor of the PET-CT, and we're going to talk about that for a bit. But before we do, do you say PET-CT or do you say CT-PET?
Well, that was a controversial point early on in the... Once the device became better known in the medical imaging community, obviously, from the nuclear medicine PET perspective, it was known as PET-CT. From the radiology point of view, it was somewhat transiently known as CT-PET. But eventually, the term PET-CT stuck. And so it's really known as PET-CT, even though if you look at some of the very early publications from 2000, for a few years after 2000, you might find papers talking about PET-CT or PET-CT, but we always refer, CT-PET or CT-PET, but we always refer to it as PET-CT from the time we first decided to put the two devices together.
Sure. For any of the non-specialists who may be listening into this podcast, most people will have heard the terms CT and PET. But could you just, without being too detailed, give a quick description of what a CT is, what is PET, in terms of their uses in people, and what is PET-CT?
Sure. Okay, so in 1972, Godfrey Hounsfield in the UK in London announced the invention of what was called the computed tomography scanner. And prior to that, 1895 onwards, when Röntgen discovered X-rays, the field of radiology had used planar X-rays to image patients, such as you're very familiar with the chest X-ray. And what this does is it puts a X-ray detector on one side of the patient and an X-ray source on one side of the patient and a detector film, or now digital detectors, on the other side, and the X-ray beams pass through the patient and are captured in the image. But of course, there is no, this is just a flat photograph, if you like, of all the tissues between the X-ray source and the detector. So it's a superimposition of all the information in your chest or whichever part of the anatomy is being imaged. It was realized that this gives no information about the structures within the body, since they're all superimposed on one image. You can't tell what is in the front, what is in the back. For many years prior to the invention of the CT scanner, different disciplines, optics, radio astronomy, and so on, had been developing algorithms that attempted to reconstruct depth information from a series of projections. And the reconstruction algorithms had been developed for other applications, as I said, in radio astronomy to try and image distant X-ray sources from the Earth, in optics and electrostatics and various other fields. And so there were these algorithms around, dating from many years prior to Hounsfield's invention. Now, his genius, if you like, was the concept of putting together projection information as the X-ray source rotated around the patient along with the detector, and using some sort of reconstruction algorithm to then reconstruct a cross-section through the patient's body. And this would be a cross-section that localized all the information at depth within the body in its correct position in the image. So the image went from a planar chest X-ray, if you like, to a transaxial slice through the patient where the bones, the organs, and other structures were correctly located. So Hounsfield worked on this and came up with his prototype and was imaging patients at the Atkinson-Morley Hospital in London and presented images in 1972. And he received the Nobel Prize in 1979 in physiology and medicine for his work. And he shared the prize with Alan Cormack, who was a mathematician developing reconstruction algorithms, even though curiously, many people were developing them, and the ones that Hounsfield used were actually not the ones that Cormack had written in his Nobel Prize-winning paper. But nevertheless, they shared the Nobel Prize for that work. And so that has then gone on to be developed and refined as the CT scanner, the computed tomography scanner. And the principle of imaging with X-rays is you're essentially imaging the anatomy of the human body. And therefore, all the structures that you're looking at are anatomical structures. It could be the liver, it could be the heart, the spleen, whatever. But it's still anatomical imaging of these different structures, and it gives you no information about the functioning of the structure. So in principle, if you image a cadaver, you wouldn't be able to tell with CT that the person had actually deceased, unless, of course, there was some structure like a bullet or something if the individual had been shot. But otherwise, it doesn't give you information on whether or not the patient that you're imaging is still functioning, still functional. Now, many years earlier, in the 1940s, a pioneer, a chemist actually, George von Hevesy, had proposed using what became known as the tracer technique, which is injecting some sort of compound into a patient and then following where this compound goes. And the principle that he adopted was to take some sort of chemical compound and then label it with a positron, with a nuclide. And the compound would ensure that what you injected went to the target. And then once it was there, because you couldn't see inside the human body, once it was there, the radioactive emissions from the nuclides attached to the compound could be detected externally, and so then you would know where it was. And this became eventually developed into the field of nuclear imaging, nuclear medicine, where compounds were radio-labeled with nuclides, and then the compound would be injected into the patient. It would go to the target organ, depending on what the chemistry of the compound was. And then the radioactive emissions would be captured by detectors outside the patient. The difference with CT is, first of all, CT is transmission imaging. So the source is outside the patient, the source and detector. In nuclear medicine, we call it active imaging, because in this case, the nuclide is injected into the patient, and then the detectors placed outside the patient capture the radioactive, the emissions from the radioactive decay. But of course, the crucial difference is that if the patient isn't functional, then when you inject the radioactive compound, it will remain at the site of injection because there's no circulation. But more interestingly, if, say, the liver is not functioning properly, when a compound which targets the liver reaches the liver, its distribution will reflect the failure of the liver to function properly. So the major difference now is that you're not imaging anatomy, you're imaging function. And so nuclear medicine imaging is generally called functional imaging, as opposed to anatomical or morphological imaging, which is the hallmark of radiology of CT. So obviously the two are different, and both are powerful techniques. But one of the, if you like, disadvantages or drawbacks of nuclear imaging is that if you have a very specific compound that, say, goes to a particular structure, I mean, let's now talk about imaging cancer. If you have a compound that goes to a particular tumor, when you look at the image, you may see uptake in this tumor, but you have no accurate idea where the tumor is located. Obviously, if it's roughly in some area of the liver and so on, but it may be just outside the liver, it may be partly in, partly out, it may be entirely within the liver. So the idea of putting together some accurate anatomical imaging technique like CT with a functional imaging technique like PET or general nuclear medicine isotopes was a very attractive proposition, but had never really been explored, although there were some preliminary work prior to our work. The idea of putting together PET with CT had not really been explored. And this is something that we decided in 1989, 1990, that it would be worth exploring, even though my entire career up to then had been in positron imaging and not in, in CT. So hopefully that will explain the major differences between PET and CT and why it's an attractive proposition to put the two sure. together.
So if a single person makes an invention, then it's very easy to understand that that person made the invention. In the case of a co-invention, how does that work? Is the initial idea one person's, or is it more distributed development of the idea between the individuals involved? Do you recall, for example, any significant moment where it was decided to do this, or was it more a gradual process?
Well, I think it obviously depends upon the sort of application and the way these things develop. Often, I think moments of sort of inspiration is how you remember it looking back, but probably it was just a lot of hard work that eventually led you to that concept. And in our case, we had developed, as I mentioned earlier, with Dr. Alan Jevons, some small detectors for imaging positron-emitting radionuclides. His interest had been initially in solid-state physics. Mine was more in the medical imaging application. And so our team at the University of Geneva Hospital in the early 80s, in collaboration with CERN, developed these small detectors for imaging positron-emitting isotopes. And fortunately, because we worked with Professor Alfred Donat, I mentioned him as a visionary nuclear medicine physician who headed the Department of Nuclear Medicine, where I was employed after my return from Buffalo. Professor Donat encouraged us to work in this field because, being a visionary in the field, he foresaw that positron emitting applications would become increasingly important, as indeed they have done. And so he encouraged us to develop this device, and we started imaging some patients with it at the university hospital. And in order to make it work, we had developed some reconstruction algorithms. I mentioned they were essential in the development of the CT scanner, and we had, along with some other groups, been working on extending them to fully imaging in three dimensions as opposed to two-dimensional cross-sectional slices. And at the Medical Research Council in London, Terry Jones, my mentor for many years, had acquired one of the very first commercial PET scanners from the company in Knoxville, Tennessee. And the company in Knoxville, Tennessee, basically the chief scientist and president of the company was Dr. Ron Nutt. And in 1987, Terry invited me to go to Hammersmith Hospital, to the Medical Research Council, and work on applying the 3D reconstruction algorithms we developed in Geneva and applying them to the PET scanner that he had acquired from CTI in Knoxville. And so this is what I did, and it was the start of a very fruitful collaboration, but it was also the first time I met the people from the company, and in particular, Dr. Ron Nutt. After we were successful in applying these algorithms, Terry Jones and I discussed the possibility of building a low-cost PET imaging system, which our proposal was to remove about 60% of the detectors from the commercial system that he had acquired from the company in Knoxville. And that would have made the system a lot less expensive. because the detectors were, in those days, the most expensive part of the PET imaging system. But in order to make that work, now with only 40% of the detectors, we needed to rotate the two banks of detectors around the patient in order to acquire an image. And so with funding from the Swiss National Science Foundation, we were able to build such a system in Geneva in collaboration with CERN, but also with the company in Knoxville, Tennessee, and Dr. Ron Nutt. So Ron and I became collaborators on this project that had been inspired by Terry Jones, and we were able to start making some pretty reasonable images of the human brain in Geneva using this low-cost, cost-effective system that consisted of components manufactured by the company in Knoxville and assembled by us in Geneva. So we had a viable device, and in fact, the company commercialized the device for a few years as one of their PET scanner designs that was a sort of entry-level design. So the sort of working together with Ron was established back in about 1989-1990 in the development of this rotating system. Then we started to use this system in Geneva at the hospital, and it garnered a lot of interest from physicians, many of whom were not familiar with PET imaging, because it was the only PET imaging going on in Geneva, probably even in Switzerland in those days. And one of the interested parties was a surgeon, whose name I remember, Dr. Rudy Egli, and he was a big supporter of ours. And one day we were discussing the results from the rotating PET scanner, and he suggested maybe putting anatomical imaging in there would be an interesting concept, because he was much more used to anatomical imaging because there were many CT scanners in the hospital and they were routinely used for surgical planning and so on. So he was very familiar with CT, but not so familiar with PET. So we started to talk about the idea of putting anatomical imaging in with functional imaging, as I explained earlier, and the difference between PET and CT. And that was in about 1991-1992. And one of the first things I did was call Dr. Ron Nutt at the company in Knoxville and say, hey, what about the idea of putting together PET with CT? And initially, there was some skepticism about it, but Ron became interested and said, well, if you guys can get research funding to build such a device, then I will help make it a reality, and that it will be a sort of co-invention between our group in Geneva at the time and the company in Knoxville. So it was really a collaboration that made it work, based on a sort of spark of an idea that arose in Geneva in about 1991, I guess.
In an article of yours that I had read, you summarize a history of the PET CT. In that summary, you had said that it was 7 years before the actual scanner was realized in a working model, and that you initially thought that those gaps in the ring of your lower cost PET, that maybe you could stick your anatomical imaging devices in there, but that didn't work out. And that eventually the solution was to place a PET scanner on the back of a CT. What stopped you from having that idea right away?
Good question. The answer is that when we originally envisaged it, our naive interpretation of the CT was that it was an X-ray source opposing a bank of X-ray detectors. And indeed, that is the concept of the CT. And you rotate, as I mentioned earlier, you rotate the source around the patient with the bank of detectors, detecting the transmission of the X-rays through the patient. And that was our concept of a CT scanner. So our original design was inspired by discussions with the surgeons and other colleagues. Well, let's just put the PET, the two banks of PET detectors in the gap between the X-ray source and the detectors. And so this was the sort of concept that we decided to try and get funded. In the case, in my case, I had been recruited to the University of Pittsburgh in 1993 while we were still thinking about this idea. And I submitted a grant based on that concept to the National Institutes of Health to try and get funding for such a design. In the meantime, we'd sort of started looking at it in more detail. And when you remove the front cover from a CT scanner, you see that the idea of putting two banks of detectors on the rotating annular support would not work, simply because there are many other components in the CT scanner mounted on the front of that rotating support. So a CT scanner is basically a rotating ring with the detectors, the X-ray source, the oil cooler, various other components and so on mounted on the front of that rotating annulus. So it wasn't going to work like that. It wasn't that simple. And so when we submitted the grant, that was the original concept was, as you expressed in the question, just to mount the components together like that on the rotating support of the CT. But in fact, the grant was very soundly rejected on its first application, as happens to many people. We didn't receive many complimentary comments from the reviewers, but undeterred, in 1995, I resubmitted it with some modifications and clarifications. And in 1995, we obtained funding. In fact, we were the top-ranked grant in that cycle. And so we received upward of $850,000 from the NIH to develop the first PET-CT. And so once we had the funding, as Ron had challenged me back in 1990-1991, get funding and we'll develop the device. With that funding, we now had to get to work. And the company CTI, back in about 1987-88, had formed a joint venture with Siemens. So they were partnered with Siemens, even though the company CTI kept controlling interest of the developments of PET scanners. And that was the reason Siemens got involved. They wanted to develop a PET scanner. And so they partnered with CTI, and that was what was being developed by the company in Knoxville under a subdivision called CPS, CTI Positron Systems, of which Ron Nutt was the president and chief technology officer. And so in collaboration with them, we decided to launch the development of a PET CT scanner. And the first thing we needed, of course, since we were PET people, was a CT scanner. And because of the collaboration with Siemens graciously agreed to provide us with a CT scanner, an old decommissioned CT scanner from their factory in Germany. And so the CT scanner was moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, to initiate the PET-CT development. And that's when, taking the covers off the front, we realized there was no way we were going to actually mount the PET components on the front. And for technical reasons, engineering reasons, you couldn't mount them actually on the back of that support. So one of the engineers at the company in Knoxville said, well, let's extend the tunnel of the scanner a little bit and mount a second ring on the back of the CT ring. And on that, we can mount the PET components. And that, in fact, is what the first prototype was. But obviously, it took some years to develop that engineering solution. So the prototype, the very first prototype PET CT scanner that was built in Knoxville, Tennessee, and shipped to the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, consisted of two rings joined together, one of which contained CT and the other of which contained the PET components mounted on the back of that device. So that was the very first PET CT, but it was an integrated system. As I'll explain a bit later when we get into the commercial development, that was not really a feasible solution for a commercial development of PET CT. But it explains why it took us several years to go from the original sketch on the back of an envelope to an actual functioning PET CT prototype.
I see. So just thinking about it from far away, not being in the weeds of trying to do the engineering, it sounds very simple to take a CT scanner and just place a PET scanner behind it. But of course, I expect that it wasn't that simple. So what were the engineering obstacles that had to be surmounted in order to achieve the first working machine?
As far as the, this is a comment that's been made certainly by a number of people. Basically, all you did was bolt a PET scanner to the back of a CT scanner, and so what's the big deal? The development of the prototype involved a number of engineering issues which had to be dealt with, some of which were not entirely expected, and one which sounds almost trivial but actually occupied a huge amount of time in the ultimate commercialization of PET CT was the deflection of the patient bed. To explain that, if you've ever seen a CT scanner, basically the bed is supported on one end. The patient with the feet near that end of the bed lies on the bed with their head pointing towards the scanner, and then the bed moves horizontally so that the patient can be moved into the scanner. It's a common feature of most imaging devices of that sort. The problem is that the support point for the bed is therefore at one end, and as the bed moves further and further away from the support, it actually deflects slightly downwards. It's easier if I had a drawing, but I hope you understand the problem. Now, with a single device, single imaging device like CT, this doesn't matter. All that matters is what happens in the 1 centimeter transaxial field of view of the scanner. But if the bed deflects slightly afterwards, this doesn't make any difference to the imaging capability. But if you put two imaging devices, one after the other, and you want them to be accurately registered, which is what you want with a combined anatomical functional imaging device, the fact that the bed deflects downwards by an amount that depends on the weight of the patient, this presents the problem that the CT is not accurately registered with the PET images. And that would have to be corrected. And that was a problem that we could only correct really with software on the device, the prototype device. But when I talk a bit more about the commercial system, I'll explain the solution there. So that was one of the major issues that we had to resolve, apart from how to mount the PET onto the CT. And another thing, which again sounds trivial, but in those days, the CT scanners, the data, if you've got a rotating component, the question is, how do you extract the data from that rotating component to the static storage device, which isn't mounted on the rotating component? And obviously, you can't use cables because they would simply wind up as you rotate. Especially when you're rotating rapidly like a CT scanner. And in those days, now it would all be done wirelessly, but in those days, the data was transmitted over carbon fiber brushes, which brushed against a rotating ring. And the power to the detectors on the rotating ring went over the same sort of mechanism. And these brushes just rub against this rotating, I think, copper strip. And of course, they get dirty and they need to be cleaned. And the cleaning was accessed from the rear part of the scanner. But now we'd mounted our PET components on there, it became a real problem as to how to clean the device. And if you don't clean it, you get data transmission errors. And in the end, it just doesn't function. So this was another soundingly trivial problem which had to be fixed. And I think the important point to make here as a general concept is that when you develop a device like a PET CT scanner and install it in a hospital, even though it's a prototype, once it's installed in a hospital and you start imaging patients, it has to work. And a prototype in a laboratory is something that you can get the students to fix or something. If it works, fine. If it doesn't work, we'll fix it tomorrow and so on. The problem with a device, a clinical device in a hospital, is that surgeons, physicians refer patients, they want images. And if you're trying to demonstrate the proof of principle, you need it to function reliably. Because once a physician, a surgeon has to cancel two or three patient schedules in order for you to fix the device, then they lose interest and they'll stop referring patients. So even though the cleaning and other issues appear not to be very important, the important issue here is that you have to keep the device working. And a prototype of the sort that we built was intrinsically not reliable. There were lots of issues because it hadn't been thought through as a basic concept from start to finish. It had been put together as two separate devices combined together and having to function as one. And so that brought in a lot of issues that would have been thought out had the device been developed from the start as a combined PET CT device. But in this case, it wasn't, as I said, it was a prototype consisting of two separate devices.
Right. Your training is scientific, but this sounds like it was a very intense engineering effort. So you must have become a very good engineer along the way.
I worked with very good engineers. It's important in these projects to work with good people. And the company in Knoxville had outstanding engineers. It's really because of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, some very, very top people, engineers and scientists that worked there on the atomic bomb project, eventually translated into other fields. And Oak Ridge is a premier lab in the US. And so a lot of the people that eventually translated into other areas got their basic original training at Oak Ridge. So we had access to some very good engineers. I had an extremely good PhD student, Thomas Beyer, who worked on the project as a PhD student from the University of Pittsburgh, and some excellent colleagues, Dr. Paul Kinahan, who was an expert in image reconstruction, and some very good physicians and technologists who, once we installed the device in Pittsburgh, were able to operate it and encourage patients to participate in the scanning.
Okay. Well, with respect to commercialization, how does one go from research and development to making a commercially produced system? And also, since it is commercial, was the invention patented? And if so, who holds the patent?
Okay, very good question. So to go from a prototype system to a commercial system is not a negligible process. The idea was funded by the National Institutes of Health. I was the principal investigator on the research grant that built it, but obviously I had the collaboration work with outstanding colleagues that I just mentioned. once we had the device at the University of Pittsburgh, we were fortunate because of the chair of the department, Dr. Richard Barron, and his colleagues were very supportive for us to use the device and have patients referred to it, even though it was a prototype. And the way it operated was that the referring physician took responsibility for the scan, which means that if anything went wrong, it was the referring physician's responsibility. And that's a very powerful mechanism by which you can develop prototypes and actually test them on patients. If you don't test them on patients, if you don't work within a hospital venue, then it's very difficult to interest the medical profession in even a very good prototype device. So we were very fortunate to have all that support within the University of Pittsburgh. And then once we were able to start taking combined PET-CT images of real patients with real problems and show that by having PET and CT acquired together, it was much more powerful than having PET and CT acquired separately. And one particular patient that I cite was a young lady, 29 years old, with a nasopharyngeal malignancy on one side. And the question she was referred to us for imaging was, had the disease spread? And if so, to what extent had it spread? Because that affected patient management. And I'm talking now in about 1998, 1999. We imaged the patient, and the images were presented to Dr. Carolyn Meltzer, who was the physician, probably the first PET-CT physician working on the scanner. And she looked at the images, and on one side of the patient, the same side as the primary tumor, a lymph node, which is typically what happens with these head and neck malignancies, the cancer moves to the lymph nodes. There was a very large lymph node with a lot of uptake of our imaging tracer, fluorodeoxyglucose, which is taken up in all cells, but you get a lot of it taken up in cancer cells. And so she saw a large node with a lot of FDG in it, and she said, well, the CT is positive, it's enlarged, and the PET is positive because there's FDG in the lymph node, but that doesn't really change much. That's a positive node. But on the contralateral side, and that's very serious in head and neck because it doesn't just cross the midline. It actually has a longer path through the body, potentially leaving malignancy elsewhere in order to appear on the opposite side of the patient's head and neck. She saw a very small node, but there was uptake in it, and that was very suspicious. Now, had she had the images separately, the uptake was not very high, so she would have probably overlooked it without the anatomy of knowing that it was located exactly over a lymph node, even though the lymph node, by radiological evaluation, was not positive. So she said, this is suspicious, and I'm going to take a chance on it and say that the patient has bilateral disease. The patient then, on the basis of that PET-CT scan, underwent a bilateral neck dissection. And indeed, the small node on the opposite side was malignant. And so this completely changed the management of the patient, because instead of having unilateral disease, the disease has spread much further. And the patient was able to begin treatment, systemic treatment for bilateral disease, much earlier than if she'd had a neck dissection on one side and then come back months later with spread of disease to the other side, whereas it was actually identifiable at the time of the original diagnosis. So it changed management, and it made us feel that this was a major breakthrough in imaging, not because putting PET and CT together was a big deal in the sort of engineering concept, if you like, but it was a big deal in the way imaging was going to be conducted, especially for patients with malignant disease.
Absolutely. So once the PET-CT became a commercial product, did you continue to play a role in its development as a commercial product? And did it make you a billionaire? Are you one of the one percenters?
Okay, so I realize that you asked a question about the patent, and that relates to what happened commercially with it. So Ron Nutt and I did file a patent, and the initial patent was a very restrictive patent. And I should here pay tribute to a longtime friend of mine who very sadly passed away with a stroke in 2008. He was a wonderful person, Dr. Bruce Hasegawa. He was a medical physicist at the University of California, San Francisco. He and I gave many talks together, and his role in this was he was the very first person to propose putting single photon emission tomography, SPECT, together with CT, and he proposed that back in the 80s before we came up with our PET-CT design in 1990-1991. And Bruce had built a SPECT-CT scanner and patented it. And in his patent, he said you could also do this with PET and CT. But of course, he didn't pursue it and he didn't propose any specific design. But I came across him while we were researching for the grant submission and made contact with him. And while he definitely was the real pioneer of dual modality imaging, multimodality imaging, or hybrid imaging, as it's sometimes called, he never pursued the PET side of things. And so when we submitted our patent, we made it very clear that the prior art that it was based upon had been initiated by Bruce in a different application area, but he had nevertheless mentioned such a possibility. And so our first patent was very specific and therefore not very strong. Eventually, Ron and I submitted a patent that was much more general in covering the entire concept. And in fact, we do hold that patent. It was issued in 2009 after I left the US and moved to Singapore. But my motivation in all this had always been on the physics side to pursue application areas where it could be helpful to people, especially patients with cancer. And even though the patent does not really cover the current designs of PET-CT, I've received a royalty from Siemens for the design since 2003, I think. But no, it doesn't make me a billionaire in any sense. I just feel very fortunate to have been able to be involved in this field and in this development and to work with some outstanding people.
I have been a practicing medical physicist now for over 30 years in radiation therapy. And I remember when the PET-CT became available. It solved a major problem for us in radiation treatment planning, as you know. And we were all excited to have a unit available. You mentioned the 29-year-old woman whose contralateral lymph node showed positive. I was going to ask you if you knew anyone up close who benefited from this technology and what emotional impact that had on you. But I suppose seeing this case so early probably did it. I imagine there must have been a profound sense of contribution that you are making in a way that most people don't get to make in such a fundamental area as to the management of cancer.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And that was indeed the first case, and I always remembered it because it was probably the first time the physician said, you know, this really made a difference to this patient, even though, of course, the prognosis in head and neck can be quite dismal. Over the years, I've had friends and colleagues that have had PET-CT images. In order to answer your questions to what I continued to do after we had been involved in the commercial development with CTI. I then moved more in the direction of using PET CT in clinical research as an imaging tool to look at different ways of imaging, different ways of imaging cancer specifically. I mean, it obviously has a role in neuro and cardiology and other areas, but cancer has been the area in which it's made major applications. And a number of friends have been fortunate enough to have early diagnosis of the disease as a result of being imaged initially on the on a PET CT scanner. And one particular anecdote, Ron Nutt and I were very fortunate to be selected to receive the very first IEEE medal in healthcare, innovations in healthcare. And it was presented to us at a meeting presentation ceremony in Montreal in 2010. And a number of other fields received there were some very distinguished people there receiving awards. But after the awards, we were assigned a table for dinner, and the other people on the table were all cancer survivors. I had attributed their survival to having been imaged with PET CT. So it gave us the opportunity to actually meet people that felt that.
Very nice. Well, even prior to that recognition, in 2000, Time magazine listed the PET CT as the invention of the year. Did that make you into a celebrity? I know that you're well known in the scientific community, but having your name in Time magazine, did public awareness increase to the point where you became hounded on the streets by autograph seekers? And were the paparazzi at your home every night looking to see what you were up to?
Not quite to that extent. I certainly received a lot of emails from friends that I had not heard from for many years that certainly did not read the Journal of Nuclear Medicine, but apparently do read Time magazine. And interestingly, the article, because you never know what journals, the newspapers are going to write, because many of them will interview you and then publish what they write without you ever having seen a draft of it. And sometimes what they publish is just not true. The Time magazine article was outstanding. And I remember I was at a meeting in Japan at the time they were writing the article, and I got a call from the journalist to go through some of his questions and so on while sitting on my bed in a hotel room in Japan. So it was actually difficult to input very much at the time, because they wanted to publish it before I even returned from my trip to the meeting in Japan. But when it was published, we were tremendously impressed with the way it was written. And in fact, the only error was in the one bit at the beginning that he didn't read to me, which was the sort of paragraph just below the title and not part of the main text, in which he described the invention as having been made by two Americans, whereas in fact I am a UK citizen and always have been. Ron is an American citizen, but apart from that a small mistake, the rest of it was extremely accurately and extremely well written, although it was largely overshadowed by the Bush-Gore hanging chads problem in Florida that was on the cover of that particular issue.
Right. I remember. So it didn't make you a public celebrity, but why is it anyway that big accomplishments in science, why is it that they do not garner the same level of public interest as accomplishments in the arts and sports? Do you have any ideas why that is?
Well, I think In a lot of cases, even though the design invention is very successful, the people behind it don't receive a lot of publicity. I don't know how many people would name Godfrey Hounsfield as the invention of the CT scanner. But a lot of the work, obviously, if it leads to a Nobel Prize, and I've been fortunate to work with people, one in particular, George Sharpack, who was a CERN physicist, and I worked with him for several years. As he moved his career from particle physics into medical imaging, he received the Physics Nobel Prize in 1992, I think, for his invention of the multi-wire proportional chamber. Unless you receive that sort of notoriety, I don't think in particular people that invent these things are searching for publicity. And, even though many people may experience a PET CT scan, I doubt if any of them or most of them really know what was behind that development any more than behind the chest X-ray or the magnetic resonance imaging systems. It's for me, it was, the publicity that came with it to some extent was interesting, but it's definitely not a motivational factor in making these sort of inventions or designs. It's much more something that comes along to some extent, but it's relatively short-lived. Obviously, Time magazine was a big deal, and it's what many people still remember, but it didn't take more than a month or two for the sort of interest and publicity from that to tail off.
There is a lot more attention today given to radiation doses received by the public from diagnostic procedures. We now have the Image Wisely and Image Gently campaigns for adults and children, respectively. Where does PET CT fit into this? And where is your opinion with regards to these issues?
So PET CT uses ionizing radiation both for the anatomical CT component and for the PET imaging component. And this is it's always been a concern about the issues of radiation and the potential of ionizing radiation to generate malignancies. But what's been obscured has been the data upon which the basic model, the linear no threshold model that is used to extrapolate to give us some idea of what is the risk of low levels of radiation. And the problem is that the term low-level radiation isn't very specific in what you mean by low level. And the data that has been used to initiate the use of the linear no-threshold model is actually data, to a large extent, based on the atomic bomb survivors, and maybe in some other areas like using medical treatments that use ionizing radiation. And then if you look at them in younger adults or children and then see what happens many years later and identify whether or not they generated secondary cancers. But the point is that all these have conflicting factors. Like if you're a child and you're subjected to levels of radiation, then there is some reason for that because most children don't receive high levels of radiation at that age. And of course, the atomic bomb exposures were much, much higher than the medical imaging levels that we use today. And so the model that has been used, this linear threshold model, is used more as a convenience than based on any real scientific data at the levels of radiation that we use in medical imaging. Now, the CT scanner was known as a device that used relatively higher levels of radiation than maybe some of the nuclear medicine procedures, and PET. So when we put it together, we were criticized for putting a higher level radiation procedure together with something that was lower level. And therefore, if a patient only had access to PET CT and not PET only, then the patient was receiving higher levels of radiation than was necessary just for the PET scan. A technique was developed to run the CT scanner at lower levels of radiation to minimize this effect. But unfortunately, that doesn't give the level of radiation for clinical CT imaging. So the radiologists were not very keen on reading those low-level radiation images. Subsequently, now, both PET and CT are using very, very low levels of radiation to image, thanks to tremendous strides in the improvements in technology than we had even back in 1998, 1999. So that improvement has resulted in the PET-CT imaging becoming extremely low levels, well below any reliable predictions from the linear no-threshold model. And as I think you know, there are other potential models that even go as far as the hormesis model that would say very low levels of radiation can actually be, to some extent, beneficial to patients. So there's a lot of work that has to be done on this particular aspect. But I think the hype in the media has been responsible for a lot of the radiation phobia that I saw, particularly in Asia, after working in Singapore for 9 years. Radiation phobia is very strong, and patients will refuse, say, a PET scan, or a PET CT scan, because they've heard that it gives them cancer. And this, of course, means that they then don't get the sort of care, the diagnostic workup and care that they need and is justified by their particular disease. So it is a problem to educate, and it's not easy because it requires concepts that maybe individuals would find difficult to understand, given that the general prevailing feeling is that radiation gives you cancer. But as we know, a particular technique, a particular compound, a particular chemical at very low doses can be beneficial, whereas at higher doses can be fatal. One I always cite is simply drinking alcohol, wine. I mean, one glass of red wine can be beneficial, but several bottles of red wine and it can be fatal. So the concept that something which is beneficial at low levels but is lethal at high levels is, there are many, many examples like that.
So you have had a very long and successful career, and the work you've done in PET CT would have been enough for anyone in terms of accomplishments. But are there close seconds in terms of other highlights that you have had in your career?
I think the development up to the PET CT was very rewarding, the rotating system that I talked about, and the development of 3D reconstruction algorithms was a major step, and we achieved that in 1989, working with the group at Hammersmith. Other groups had also developed it, but we were one of the first publications that used 3D reconstruction algorithms for PET. But I think having had the opportunity to work with the company that commercialized PET CT, and then to be able to evaluate the new systems as they were developed by the company, and to apply them to clinical problems has been very, very rewarding indeed, particularly in the field of cancer. So I've been very fortunate to be able to work with physicians and actually develop imaging strategies that help really help patients. And I guess the sort of latter highlight was to be recruited to Singapore in 2009 to set up the Singapore Clinical Imaging Research Center, where I was appointed director in 2010. And we were able to introduce PET imaging, PET CT imaging, PET MR imaging into the Singapore community as a research tool, and do many valid research applications on the Asian population in Singapore. And that's why the radiation phobia hype was so unfortunate, because recruiting patients for these studies was not always easy because of their preconception that any level of radiation was dangerous, whereas I don't think any radiation physicist believes that. It's all a case of degree, and high levels obviously are harmful, whereas the very low levels that we use are essentially riskless and may even be beneficial. But that's a very hard message to get across to the population. And in Asia, I found it particularly acute in trying to get patients to participate in the research studies that we had superb tools to be able to carry out.
Right. There is an abundance of information on the internet today about everything. In this abundance, one can find mountains of conflicting claims about what science knows or doesn't know. Apart from a very strange anti-science attitude that seems to have taken hold in some people, how is the interested public supposed to keep up? How do we determine what is real, reliable information and what isn't? Because the problem with the LNT is you can find, I'm sure, arguments for both sides, and it would be a matter of whether the public trusts the scientific community to be straightforward with them, or if they have an anti-science bias for whatever reason. So how does the public get reliable information?
Well, I think this is a major problem, and it's certainly being amplified and exacerbated by what's going on in the US at the moment, in particular the issues surrounding the coronavirus. I think from my own experience that people, as you call the interested public, they tend to want very specific answers to their questions, like, should I take this? Should I do that? Should I get that particular study? So it's often with biological systems in particular, they're very complex, and it's really difficult to give a single answer. And I've seen this recently where the issue of taking various drugs or predicting death rates from the coronavirus has been heavily criticized because the models have not been precise. And so the information that the public extract from what they see on television, what they read in newspapers, is that the scientists don't really know what they're talking about, because they can't even tell us how many people are going to die. And the issues with that are related to simply the complexity of the problems. And while should I buy this laptop or should I buy that one may have a very specific answer, whether or not a particular drug is helpful generally does not. And how to get the right sort of information is not easy. And what we used to find in running the Clinical Imaging Center in Singapore was that people would come and say, well, I'm not having a PET CT scan because I looked on the internet and saw that it causes cancer. Or I'm not having this study because I saw that there's a 50% chance of that. And so anybody can access this information. They have no idea no way of checking how reliable it is, and no way of really getting an answer to their question. And unfortunately, with the way things are going, especially in the US, this sort of information is now provided by non-scientific, non-medical news anchors, as opposed to the experts that really know the answers to the questions. But it's always been difficult to get across an answer. Well, you know, we're not sure, but it's going to be in this range. And people have, I think, a hard time understanding a range. When you want a specific answer to a question, you want to know what the number is, not it's somewhere in this range. It's the same with probabilities. It's hard to know what's the point. You know, there's a 50% chance it's going to rain today. Well, you know, that's very difficult to understand whether you should take your umbrella or not, based on that sort of information. And getting reliable information with the fact that everybody has access to so much now is difficult. And I don't really see it getting any easier in the short term, given that there are so many different, these conspiracy theories that take any sort of semi-facts and twist them and then propagate them, and people don't know whether to believe them or not. So it's very difficult to get answers to these questions, but you need to, I think, trust the scientists to give you reliable information. Although you raise a good point with the LNT model, it's been used extensively, even though it's not really based on scientific data relative to the area in which it's being applied.
Sure. I mean, I have looked at articles on whether vaccines cause autism or not. And if I'm a non-scientist and I'm reading things, I can read two opposing point of views, which, as a non-scientist, sound equally credible. So I think it's a very difficult job for the public, if they are not already biased towards conspiracy theories, that it is very difficult for them to parse the information that is out there.
Yes, and I think the other point that's, you know, comes up repeatedly is because of the complexity of biological systems and the way they react to various factors means that you can be told today that this is good for you and then in 3 months be told that it's not good for you. And there's very little other than maybe smoking that has ever sort of remained bad for you at all levels. So it is very confusing for people to know what to do. I agree with that.
So are you retired from the Clinical Imaging Center now?
Yes, I retired in June of 2018. That's when I decided it was time to take a break from medical imaging, since I'd been doing it then for about 50 years.
I know a few people who have retired, and they tell me they are busier now than ever. Are you finding that same phenomenon?
Yes, but in a totally different way. My wife and I moved to Whistler when we left Singapore, and we did so because it's a very healthy, very pretty place to live. We're both very keen skiers, so we have immediate access to a vast array of ski slopes. And then Whistler's about 670 meters in altitude, so it's a very sort of healthy place to live. We can run, we can bike. I've taken up playing a bit of golf and things like that. We scuba dive, not here in Whistler, but travel to various places for that. And I do keep in touch with colleagues. I've decided not to be really a consultant for any particular area, but I do still consult with a company in North Carolina who develop a device that ensures that the injection of radioactivity is done cleanly and properly into the patient, because it's an area that's been overlooked, often just taken on faith that it's done, and it's critical to the ultimate images and the interpretation of the images that it's done properly. So I consulted with them for a number of years now as they develop a small device to monitor radiation injections. And I try to give back a little bit to the community by some medical imaging lectures at various schools that I'll try and keep up in the future. But I didn't want to become a progressively out of date consultant or something. So I decided to sort of move in the direction of keeping healthy and staying fit.
Sounds good to me. Well, thank you very much for a very informative and interesting discussion. I'm sure our listeners will enjoy it as much as I have. And I hope that your opportunity now to apply yourself to your outdoor adventures goes well. Thank you very much, Dr. Townsend.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I very much appreciate the opportunity to participate in this, and I very much enjoy chatting to you, Dr. Ramsey.
Special thanks to our host, Dr. Ramsey, and to our guest, Dr. Townsend, for joining us to discuss his work and the PET CT scanner. As always, if you or someone you know has a project or expertise you think would make a good topic for our show, visit versinphysics.com/podcasts and introduce yourself. We'd love to hear from you.